Eventually, Cromwell became a member of Parliament and a vocal defender of the common people in their grievances against the aristocracy. Yet, he felt marked by providence for something larger than politics. He had visions of a great crusade. In 1642, Parliament, in a bitter struggle with Charles I, voted to cut off the king's funds until he agreed to limits on royal power. When Charles refused, civil war broke out between the Cavaliers, supporters of the king who wore their hair long, and the Roundheads, the rebels so-called since they cropped their hair short. Parliament's most fervent supporters were Puritans like Cromwell, who saw the war against the king as his chance, more than his chance, his calling. Although Cromwell had no military background, he hurriedly formed a troop of 60 horsemen from his native Cambridgeshire. His aim was to incorporate them in a larger regiment, gain military experience by fighting under another commander, and slowly prove his worth. He was confident of ultimate victory, for he saw his side as unbeatable. After all, God was on their side, and all his men were believers in the cause of creating a more pious England. Despite his lack of experience, Cromwell was something of a military visionary. He imagined a new kind of warfare spearheaded by a faster, more mobile cavalry, and in the war's first few months, he proved a brave and effective leader. He was given more troops to command, but soon realized that he had grossly overestimated the fighting spirit of those on his side. Time and again, he led cavalry charges that pierced enemy lines, only to watch in disgust as his soldiers broke order to plunder the enemy camp. Sometimes he tried to hold part of his force in reserve to act as reinforcements later in the battle, but the only command they listened to was to advance, and in retreat, they were hopelessly disordered. Representing themselves as crusaders, Cromwell's men were revealed by battle as mercenaries fighting for pay and adventure. They were useless. In 1643, when Cromwell was made a colonel at the head of his own regiment, he decided to break with the past. From now on, he would recruit only soldiers of a certain kind. Men who, like himself, had experienced religious visions and revelations. He sounded out the aspirants, tested them for the depth of their faith. Departing from a long tradition, he appointed commoners, not aristocrats, as officers. Cromwell made his recruits sing psalms and pray together. In a stern check on bad discipline, he taught them to see all their actions as part of God's plan. And he looked after them in an unusual way for the times, making sure they were well-fed, well-clothed, and promptly paid. When Cromwell's army went into battle, it was now a force to reckon with. The men rode in tight formation, loudly singing psalms. As they neared the king's forces, they would break into a pretty round trot, not the headlong and disorderly charge of other troops. Even in contact with the enemy, they kept their order, and they retreated with as much discipline as when they advanced. Since they believed that God was with them, they had no fear of death. They could march straight up a hill into enemy fire without breaking step. Having gained control over his cavalry, Cromwell could maneuver them with infinite flexibility. His troops won battle after battle. In 1645, Cromwell was named Lieutenant General of the Cavalry in the New Model Army. That year, at the Battle of Naseby, his disciplined regiment was crucial in the Roundheads' victory. A few days later, his cavalry finished off the Royalist forces at Langport, effectively putting an end to the first stage of the Civil War. Interpretation. That Cromwell is generally considered one of history's great military leaders is all the more remarkable, given that he learned soldiery on the job. During the second stage of the Civil War, he became head of the Roundhead armies, and later, after defeating King Charles and having him executed, he became Lord Protector of England. Although he was ahead of his times with his visions of mobile warfare, Cromwell was not a brilliant strategist or field tactician. His success lay in the morale and discipline of his cavalry. And the secret to those was the quality of the men he recruited, true believers in his cause. Such men were naturally open to his influence and accepting of his discipline. With each new victory, they grew more committed to him and more cohesive. He could ask the most of them. Above all else, then, pay attention to your staff, to those you recruit to your cause. Many will pretend to share your beliefs, but your first battle will show that all they wanted was a job. Soldiers like these are mercenaries and will get you nowhere. True believers are what you want. Expertise and impressive resumes matter less than character and the capacity for sacrifice. Recruits of character will give you a staff already open to your influence, making morale and discipline infinitely easier to attain. This core personnel will spread the gospel for you, keeping the rest of the army in line. As far as possible in this secular world, make battle a religious experience, an ecstatic involvement in something transcending the present. Reversal. If morale is contagious, so is its opposite. Fear and discontent can spread through your troops like wildfire. The only way to deal with them is to cut them off before they turn into panic and rebellion. Waste no time and deal with the whole group. Appeal to their pride and dignity. Make them feel ashamed of their moment of weakness and madness. Remind them of what they have accomplished in the past and show them how they are falling short of the ideal. This social shaming will wake them up and reverse the dynamic.